Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, July 11th, 2010, and this is show number 268. Well, it's all over for the Netherlands, I'm afraid. Sorry, Margaret, but Spain is sure a happy place tonight. Now, I'm not a huge soccer follower, but it was impossible to not get wrapped up in these games. At the very least, I'm going to miss the Vuvuzelas, you know? Well, before I get into the show, I have to warn you that we're taking 3 days off for a little family vacation to Disneyland next week. I know they're supposed to be all grown up now, but we've never done the stay at a Disneyland hotel thing, and we've always wanted to do that. I'm looking forward to getting to the parks early, then maybe back to the pool for some relaxation and nap time, then back to the parks for dinner and actually staying awake late enough for fireworks. A friend of ours has gotten us reservations at the exclusive Club 33. I have no idea what that is, but I know it's hard to get into, so it must be good, right? I'm also looking forward to seeing World of Color. It's a new light show fountain thingy at California Adventure. Our friend Mari worked on the construction and design of it, and it sounds magnificent. It's supposed to put the fountains at the Bellagio in Vegas to shame. But most of all, I'm looking forward to playing with my family for a few days. The reason I'm telling all of you this is because it means I'm going to lose pretty much my main 3 days of production time for the show. I usually do no work at all on Mondays, teeny bit on Tuesdays, and then I kick into gear on Wednesday. But I'm going to be gone Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And that's where you come in. If you've been playing with a cool piece of Mac software or Windows or Linux software, and you've been thinking that the NoSillaCast audience would like to hear about it, now is the time to pull out that trusty microphone and make your debut. I could really use your help here, guys. Try to keep it between 3 and 5 minutes long and avoid using that internal microphone on your computer. Those recordings are usually pretty rough on the ears. Make sure you send me links to the products you talk about, too, so I can put them in the show notes. And if you'd like to tell people your Twitter name or your website, send me that, too. Thanks a lot. I'd really appreciate the help. Now, let's get into some tech. As I explained in a previous episode, I've decided to start using my iPhone as an iPod, at least in my car, for which Nightwise called me Captain Obvious. Well, all right, I could take that title, I guess. It took me a long time to figure out it would actually do that. Anyway, I also explained that the day I started using it in my car was the day I bought the bumper case off my friend Danny, only to find out that the hole for the dock connector wasn't wide enough for the connector to my car stereo. My friend David Roth tweeted me that the Griffin Reveal case is much like the Apple bumper case, but with a clear back on it and a much larger opening. The Reveal for iPhone is a one-piece polycarbonate shell with an ultra-thin rubber interior lining accent. According to the site at griffintechnology.com, it adds just 1.6 millimeters in thickness to the iPhone. Well, having already dropped $30 on a case that didn't work for me, and since I had Steve Dremel it out a bit, I can't take that back either, I was intrigued, but I wanted to make sure this new one would fit my car and fit to my car adapter before I paid $25 for this case. It looked great, so I dropped a line to their tech support email address asking how big the opening was. Now, I entitled this section in the show notes, Griffin Rocks, and here's why. Catherine from Griffin wrote back to me, not just with the dimensions of the opening, but also with a photograph of her holding the iPhone so I could see what the holes looked like. She told me the dimensions were 1 inch by 1/4 inch. Would you believe that the connector for my car is 1/16 inch longer and 1/32 thicker than that opening? Now, I was pretty happy with Catherine saving me the $25, but her answer when I told her this was the best part of it. She wrote back one more time wishing me luck and telling me that they expect to have more cases in about a month and that I should check back again with them if my quest has not come to conclusion yet. I was impressed by the speed of response from Griffin and the incredible level of help by Catherine in particular. I hope her bosses are listening, and I can guarantee I will continue buying from Griffin in the future. When I was at All Things Digital, also known as D8, we got VIP tickets from Tesla Motors to drive the Tesla Roadster. It's a $140,000 electric sports car. Sunday, Steve and I went to the showroom in Santa Monica, and we actually got to drive the car. Now, let me give some background first. This car goes 245 miles on a charge with zero emissions. But here's the best part. It goes 0 to 60 in 3.7 seconds. To give you an idea, that's faster than a Maserati and several flavors of Ferraris when I went and looked it up. When we first got there, David, the marketing manager, gave us a tour of the car. He started with the electric motor and battery compartment. He showed us the golf club bag-sized trunk and explained the cooling system from under the hood. He took us into the mechanic side of the showroom, which was so clean you could literally eat off the floor. He explained that there's virtually no oil used in this car, basically a small cup full for the motor itself, so the mechanics simply don't get dirty. He said they ask people to come in once a year for a checkup with their cars, but the maintenance is virtually nothing. He showed us the glowing blue plug in the side of the car where it was charging from the wall. They designed the Tesla with the charger inside the car, which means you can actually plug it into a conventional 110 power outlet in the wall or a 220-volt outlet like the kind, the electric dryer uses. You get a full charge in about 6 hours from the 220-volt outlet, which is a lot faster than it does out of the 110. If you're really impatient, you can buy what they call the home connector, which is a wall-mounted unit which will charge you up in less than 4 hours. And it doesn't cost you an arm and a leg. I think he said it was around $800. When it came time to drive the car, he actually drove it out of the showroom out through a pair of just regular double doors, these glass doors. He claimed he wasn't nervous, but I don't think Steve or I took a breath the whole time he was driving out. He could have had a half inch of clearance on the left-hand side, and the side view mirror just skimmed under the door handle. That's how low this car is. Now, don't worry, there's a video in the show notes where you can see just how close he got. Nerves of steel that guy had, I'm telling you. So anyway, David got in the driver's seat with me in the passenger side, with Steve looking sadly on as we drove away. David made a turn onto a major but unpopulated road and suddenly hit it. I'm telling you guys, this thing was a freaking rocket ship. I was laughing so hard. I was just amazed. This too is on the video, luckily. Steve's description later was perfect. The acceleration was so dramatic it reminded him of the Superman ride at Six Flags. So then David pulls over, and that was my entire driving lesson. I got in the driver's seat and took off. It was so much fun to drive. I kept letting it slow way down and then slamming on the accelerator. I was in love. I do have to tell you, though, I didn't like it so much on the turns as much as I thought I would. Might have been because we were in a residential neighborhood, and somehow it just didn't seem right to drive 60 miles an hour in, right next to houses. The steering wheel is pretty compact, which felt a bit odd to me. At one point, I had to merge in from the right into traffic, and I had to look over my left shoulder, but there is no looking over your left shoulder in this car. It is a solid block of car right there. There is zero visibility. I mean, nothing. It's not like you can kind of see. You can't see anything. You absolutely must depend on your left side view mirror, which made me pretty nervous. Kind of scary, actually. Another thing I did like was that the Tesla uses regenerative braking, which is where it slows the car down by converting the kinetic energy into stored energy back into the batteries. The result is that in stop-and-go traffic, you can basically just feather the accelerator, not using the brakes nearly as often as in a conventional car. Well, Steve finally got his turn, and while I wasn't with him on the drive, I don't think I've ever seen Steve grin as big as he did when he came back in the car. Clearly, he's going to be digging into the couch cushions to see if we've misplaced $140,000 in there somewhere. I asked David if he's actually been scared when someone was driving him in the car, and he said that he had a former race car driver that did scare him. They're coming up to this intersection, and David told him to take a turn at the light. But he assumed that this guy didn't catch those instructions because he was still going 70 miles an hour as he got to the intersection. The guy hit the brakes and took the turn at a full 50 miles an hour. Yeah, I guess I can see that would make you kind of nervous. Now, if you like the idea of a racy car that has zero carbon emissions, but you've got family members who might actually like to come along, they're coming out with a sedan next year entitled simply the Model S. This one's expected to run around $50,000. Much more reasonable. Still not cheap, but at least not stratosphere numbers. It is a gorgeous car. It's been made much more comfortable than the Roadster, and it does 0 to 60 in a much more modest 5.6 seconds, which is actually on par with the 2011 Acura TL, so it's not at all in the same class as the sports car. The Roadster has very minimal tech inside. I did spot an iPod dock connector and some very small display screens. In contrast, the Model S will have a 17-inch touchscreen with 3G connectivity, streaming radio, and GPS navigation. The Model S can also go quite a bit farther on a charge. The maximum battery pack will take you 300 miles. Not quite sure how this works, but evidently you can swap out battery packs in 1 minute. They sell a 160 and 230-mile pack as well, along with a 45-minute quick charge. I'm not quite sure how that works or how much it costs to have all those battery packs or whether you can swap them out yourself, but I guess I have time to figure that all out since the car isn't even for sale yet. I highly suspect that you might need a crane if you were to do this yourself. But you can reserve one if you're willing to put down a $5,000 deposit right now. Well, at least I got a Tesla t-shirt. Anyway, check out the video on podfeet.com and you can sigh along with us. But whatever you do, just don't tell Honda Bob what I did.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
How do I?
What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, Jim Sewell has a dumb question for us today. Allison, I have a dumb question for you that someone may know the answer to. I did some dumb stuff I found when I started surfing the net for my Mac when I first got it. One of them was something to keep my dock clean. I don't want it that clean now, and I was hoping you or someone else would know how to reverse it. The problem I have is that if I drag an app onto my dock, like say Firefox for example, then it sits there like a good little app until I reboot. Then when the computer comes back up, the only things in my dock are those that are running and the trash can. No Firefox. So do you know of anything I could have done to mess myself up, and more importantly, how to fix it? Okay, the bad news, guys, is that I had no clue how to answer this one. The good news is that before I even read Jim's question, he wrote back with the answer. I'm including his question and answer here because, as he said, he hopes by sending both it might help someone else someday. Here's his answer. I've no idea what I did do to my dock originally, but I found the answer in case you could use it. I found a site that said to do this. Delete the files com.apple.doc.plist and com.apple.doc.db from the user's account library preferences. Then enter kill all doc command in the terminal and press enter. This resets anything done to the dock and puts it back into factory new state. From what I'm learning, this type of action will reset any app that has a plist file, but you should probably make a backup copy of anything you delete until you see if it works. I have no idea what I did to my dock originally, but I found the answer in case you can use it. Hopefully it will help someone else. Well, I'm telling you, Jim, that sure would have been a puzzler, and it still puzzles me how you could have caused this in the first place. I did a quick search online, though, and I found tons of people with this same problem. Most of the people answering first start by patiently explaining to the person how the dock works, that apps you open show up in the dock when you quit them, and the person with the problem then patiently answers back that they know how the dock works. After about 10 people do this to the poor person, someone finally steps in and gives the exact same answer you just found. I'm sure this felt like a dumb question, but as with all dumb questions, they rarely are. Thanks, Jim, for sending this in as a question and luckily as the answer. Well, speaking of Jim Sewell, he stepped in and offered me some really good advice this week on how to make podfeet.com a bit more calming and less cluttered looking. I describe his advice as good because we didn't lose any primary functionality, but it looks cleaner now, I think, and it was things I was willing to change. I am still open to suggestions, but here's what we did so far. We moved what I'll call the alternative ways to subscribe to the podcast over to the menu bar item I already had called Subscribe to the Podcast. That's where people can find the Miro link, the XML links, things like that. Those aren't really mainstream, and if people really want them, they can find them there. That got rid of some of the more jarring color contrast, leaving us with PayPal, Amazon, and ScreenSteps. PayPal and Amazon both use a gold that's kind of similar to the Podfeet color, and ScreenSteps has a turquoise color that's not far off from the overall design. Probably the best advice Jim gave me was to change the color of the two Twitter feeds in the right sidebar. If you haven't been over to the site lately, you can watch the NoSilicast Live audience members' tweets and the Mac Roundtable members' nonsense as well. I like having it there. It's the easiest way for me to watch what my closest friends are up to. I had the color for the widget set to a dark turquoise, and it really dragged your eye over there, especially since it moves each time someone blathers about the cheese sandwich they just had for lunch. I grabbed the pale gray color of the comments and changed it to that color, and now I really like it. Jim thinks it's a bit too pale, but my theme is currently ignoring my quest to change the comment color to a darker gray, so I'm going to leave it for now. I'm going to give in and leave it be until I can figure out how to change them both at the same time. After moving the crazy colored stuff in the left sidebar, that kind of left a big gap under the stuff that I did keep, and that also gave me room to move over the blog roll and podcast listing so you have easier access to the people I find really interesting. I'm trying to find the toggle to change the color of the little bars next to those links, too. It's going to be a pale gray when and if I ever hunt down that place to change it. Now, I've given Stu Helm of the International Mac Podcast a bunch of grief over how often he redesigns his websites, so I have to expect a little bit of flack here, but I defend myself because this wasn't a full site redesign, just some pleasing changes to make it a little more enjoyable while not changing the functionality of the site. If there's things you'd like to see included or perhaps stuff you never use, drop me a line and I might take your advice on it. Thanks, Jim, for all your help. How many times do you have to answer the same question over and over again? Do you have a brother who seems to forget what you teach him? Maybe your son likes to make you repeat yourself. What if you had a way to create a tutorial for them that walked them through the steps to, say, reset the router, add album artwork in iTunes, or maybe run their backups? What if it was actually fun to make that tutorial and not drudgery? What if those tutorials were so pretty and instructive that your family members and friends were even more impressed because of your professionalism? This is not a pipe dream. You can actually do this. For only $40 for the home version of Screen Steps, or $80 for the pro version, if you want to go nuts making giant manuals, you can do all this. Heck, you can knock 25% off that price of Screen Steps by using my coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, over at screensteps.com when you finally break down and buy it. You owe it to yourself to get these people off your back and have fun doing it. In one of my other reviews, I came across a software company called ByteSquared at ByteSquared.com. One look at their site and I could tell they had some cool products I needed to play with. I gave them a holler and they graciously agreed to a review of their product Office Squared HD for the iPad and iPhone. Office Squared HD is a word processor and spreadsheet application. The first thing I liked is that it doesn't come with a presentation application. I make like 2 presentations a year in my play life, so I don't really need Keynote, and you know I won't put PowerPoint on any of my tools. I loaded up Office Squared HD on my iPad, and I was greeted by a left column entitled Files and a large window on the right. At the top was a nice, obvious plus button. Click plus, and Office HD asks you if you want a document or a workbook. Simple as that. Let's start with the document first. Enter a name for the file, and you're off to the races. The big window pane shows all of the typical menu bar thingies, you know, font and size, bold, italic, underlined colors, and highlighting left, center, right, and full justified text buttons. Not enough options? Flick your finger to the left on that menu bar and you've got bullets, numbers, paragraph indents, tables, graphic inserts, zoom, undo, and redo buttons. Pretty much all a mother could want. For the most part, the buttons are easy to select, but I do remember once or twice having a little trouble hitting the buttons right on. I tested out lots of the text changes, making my font huge, changing it to blue, underline bolding. All of these worked flawlessly. I even tried inserting a table. That worked okay, but if the text is left justified, it doesn't leave any pad in the cell, so text is kind of slammed up against the border. I didn't readily find a way to add some pad, but I tried centering the text and that made it look really nice. It'd be good to have a pad option, though. You can even embed tables inside tables, which I discovered when I tried to edit the number of rows and columns in an existing table. I had trouble figuring out how inserting images was supposed to work. The Insert Image button was very obvious. It looked just like the one in every other iPad app, and that opened the standard media browser. But that's where I got confused. After choosing the photo, it showed it with some gray bars covering up the top third and the bottom third, and below that it said Move and Scale. I tried moving and scaling with my fingers, but no matter what I did, that photo would spring back to its original position with those gray bars, which are actually the crop bars. When I put the image into the document, sure enough, it cropped it into this long, narrow strip. Well, sometimes Kyle can see things that I can't see, so I asked him to try it without telling him how I was doing it. And sure enough, he took a photo. He was able to slide it around to pan, zoom in, and crop it. I showed him how I was having the problem that he didn't run into, and we were able to reproduce it. I tested a bunch of photos, and I couldn't find the pattern for the longest time. Finally, Kyle figured it out that if the keyboard is showing, the photo crop slash insertion tool gets all messed up. Hide the keyboard, and it's fully functional. I was really glad Kyle figured that out. I wrote to the developers, and they explained that the crop problem is fixed in the version they have in testing right now, and they also taught me how to resize images by double-tapping on them and dragging the handles. I felt kind of dumb that I couldn't figure that part out on my own. I'll hold out judgment on the other issues on cropping images till the next revision comes out of testing, especially since I had trouble with one image that I wasn't actually able to delete. Now, let's try creating a workbook. Just like creating a document, it's easy peasy to get started. You have all of the menu bar options for fonts and all that, and of course, options to change the format of the cells from text to numbers to dollars and all that stuff. Again, you sweep the menu bar to the left and right to access the different options. I think I like that even better than the design of Office for computers, where menus are embedded inside other menus. Flipping side to side is really a natural way to look for things if you have a finger to touch the screen. Let's not even get started on the ribbon. Well, I had one problem entering text into cells. It kept flipping from text on the keyboard to numbers if I hit a space between words. I tried making sure the format of the cell was text, but it still flipped back and forth, which was really annoying. Oddly, a couple of times it would stay on the text input, but that was very rare. I wrote again to the guys at ByteSquared, and they said this bug has also been fixed in version 3.4, which is going to be sent over to Apple any minute now. It may even be up there by the time you hear this review. I created some equations in my workbook, which worked okay, but you have to type in the equation by hand. You can't, for example, hit the sum button and then drag across a series of cells to enter the region for summing. It does try to make some assumptions, so if you're in a cell below three numbers, hitting the sum button will sum the three cells above, which is nice. I enjoyed formatting cells, which is one of my favorite things to do when I can't figure out the problem I'm actually trying to solve. I find it's a way of making myself feel as though I'm doing real work, but in reality, I'm just playing around. I justify this delusion by telling myself that good formatting of a spreadsheet makes your point much more clear for the recipient of my spreadsheet. It's my story and I'm sticking to it, okay? Well, I'm personally more comfortable in the single spreadsheet strategy of Office Squared HD and Excel, not this crazy out-of-the-box way Numbers does it with multiple spreadsheets on a single page. It's just crazy talk. You can easily make multiple pages in a single workbook with a familiar plus button on the tabs at the bottom of your workbook if you so require. A surprise feature for this platform was the ability to freeze panes. That's the feature where you want to be able to scroll your workbook while, say, keeping a row and a column in view so you can see your header and row names. It was very exciting to see that in a simple iPad app. A big and very welcome differentiator for Office Squared HD versus iWork for the iPad is the ability to make folders in the left pane for organizing your different documents. Actually, I haven't found a single application for the iPad that actually has folders before I found Office Squared HD. I'm sure they're out there, but iWork, Penultimate, Paperdesk, none of these support any sort of organization, which is just nuts for me unless it's a demo application. I did have one big isolated problem with Office Squared HD. At one point, it completely froze up on me. It didn't respond to any of my on-screen taps, so I quit and went back in, and it continued to be non-responsive. It was still frozen in that document. I even restarted the iPad, and it still wouldn't respond. I finally deleted the app and re-downloaded it, and it worked fine after that. I never had a lick of trouble with it, but I did lose the few dummy documents I had created. The guys over at ByteSquared said that they had not seen this before, so hopefully that's just a one-time-in-the-blue issue. Office Squared HD actually has a help file in it. I have not seen that in any other iPad app yet either. It's well-organized and easy to use, and of course I didn't read a bit of it. Office Squared HD also has a bunch of settings you can mess with. One option was to enable file sharing and connect via an IP address, but I couldn't get it to work at first. Bart suggested that the problem was because Starbucks, where I was milking their free Wi-Fi, might have enabled at least some rudimentary security protocols to keep people from connecting to other patrons' machines. I drove home and tried again, and it worked beautifully. So here's how it works. First, you turn on file sharing inside Office Squared HD in the preferences, and then it gives you a URL, which is actually the IP address the iPad is sitting on, followed by :8080. Now, you have two ways to connect. You can connect via your web browser or through the Finder. If you go through a web browser, you see a very old-school-looking file structure, but it's totally usable. You see your files in these folders, you can click on them as links, and they download to your computer. They open in whatever application you have set for that format. A workbook opened in Excel for me, a rich text format document, RTF, opened in TextEdit, and a plain old document opened in Bean, my free word processor of choice on the Mac. It could not have possibly been easier. Office Squared HD even has an option to keep the iPad from going to sleep so your server, quote-unquote, stays up. The really cool thing about the web interface is there's an upload button, too, so you can plop files into the iPad so you can work on them in the go. If you'd rather see your iPad in the Finder, you can simply go up to Go in the Finder menu bar and pull down to Connect to Server, or simply hit Command-K. Then you can type in the IP address, and instantly, you've got the iPad Office Squared HD file structure showing right in your Finder. You can copy files out or drag files in, just like any file server. I even tried putting a JPEG in there, figuring that's going to fail, because Office Squared HD doesn't create images. But when I look at them in the file structure within the iPad, my image popped right up on screen in Office Squared HD. Hey, this could be cool. So next I tried a PDF file, and sure enough, my iPad's file structure updated instantly, and I was able to view my PDF and even use pinch and zoom to see what I needed to read. This is so cool. I think this is even more powerful than things like GoodReader, because I can actually create documents, but also view anything GoodReader can view. If you're worried about security, Office Squared HD does allow you to turn on file sharing security so that you need a username and password to get into the documents folder for Office Squared HD. All right, it's about time to get close to the bottom line for this application. iWork is $10 per application, so for numbers and pages combined, you'd be out $20. You do get perhaps a bit more sophisticated set of tools. Like in Pages, you can drag the image around with your finger and squeeze and pinch, and it really works a lot better. In Office Squared HD's workbooks, they don't even have graphs. I hope they add that soon. It's kind of a big missing piece. But iWork's ability to share files via iWork.com is not nearly as easy and sophisticated as the web and Finder interface you get with Office Squared HD. By the way, it probably works on Windows too. I just don't know how to do it. If your documents are sensitive, maybe you don't want to share them online at all, like you have to with iWork.com. With Office Squared HD, you aren't ever sharing them with anyone but yourself. iWork doesn't let you move files like JPEGs and PDFs in and out at will because you can't add documents to iWork.com, except one way. You have to be a MobileMe subscriber as well to use iWork.com. So the bottom line must include the price. Office Squared HD is a grand total of... drumroll, please. All right, I'm imagining right now Chevy Chase's family in Christmas Vacation. Remember, he's plugging in the lights and he goes, drumroll, and they all go... sorry, that was a side lobe. I just thought that was funny. Anyway, Office Squared HD is a grand total of $8. Yep, all this fun for $8. I'd pay $8 just for the file structure. Anyway, they have an iPhone application as well, but you'll have to shell out another $6 to get that. I didn't test out the iPhone version, but I did encourage the developers to abandon their charge twice model, because I don't know, it just seems like if you buy it on one, it should be on both. All right, final bottom line time. Assuming that the issues of image insertion in documents and text entry in workbooks are fixed in the soon-to-be-released version 3.4, I'm really pleased with Office Squared HD. I'd like to see a future enhancement to add graphs in workbooks, but other than that, it seems to have most of the features I enjoy. Like I said, I would keep this if only for the ability to manage files so beautifully. $8 is a great price for all this goodness. Go check out Office Squared HD and all their other fine products at bytesquared.com. You've heard me mention from time to time that along with getting a great mechanic with Honda Bob, you also get dreadful jokes. For example, every time he leaves, I mean every time he leaves, he holds up his thumb and index finger and he says, "So long." He will often discuss your need for a chrome muffler bearing, or he'll pretend that he's relieving himself when draining the fluids from your car. Well, Nightwise has produced a little Honda Bob promo for the show that I think you might enjoy.
Are you tired of having too much laughter in your life? Does your living room look like a stage for a stand-up comedian as your better half cracks just a great one-liner and makes you roll on the floor with laughter? Well, fear no more, because you can call Bad Joke Bob. Bad Joke Bob is a mobile service that will come to your house and tell you bad jokes. If you live in the Orange County or LA area and want to hear terrible, terrible comedy, you can call Bad Joke Bob. You don't even have to leave your own house. Bad Joke Bob will come to you. And occasionally, he will also fix your Honda and Acura. So, are you just tired of LOLs and ha ha ha? Well, call Bad Joke Bob. His bad jokes are legendary.
Well, if that hasn't turned you off Honda Bob, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. H.A. Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, Honda Worldwide. What's that time of the week again? It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. How are you this lovely Saturday, Bart?
Lovely.
Isn't it lovely?
It has been raining constantly since about yesterday morning, and apparently it might stop by tomorrow morning.
Ew.
Yeah, I know. Ireland is not usually like that. Usually we say here that if you don't like the weather, you wait 5 minutes and you have different weather. But well, this isn't good.
I got very, very wet
yesterday.
Oh, I guess I shouldn't complain about the fact that our early morning low clouds have been lasting till early afternoon.
Oh, no.
Before we get utter sunshine. You know, right now we have diffuse sunlight, so that's just horrible. We're all complaining about it here.
I love diffuse sunlight. Perfect macro lighting.
So for a person who really likes to vacation in sunny, warm climates, what would happen if someone like me and Steve decided to go to Ireland for a holiday in, say, late August?
It depends. You could be very lucky. If you're only going to be here for a couple of days, you could have fantastic weather, every bit as good as that in California. Or you could have rain.
Well,
or most likely, both.
Well, so I guess we're going to spring it now. Steve and I are going to go on a podcasting wild tour of Europe. We're going to go visit Bart in Ireland.
All three countries of Europe.
All three countries. Well, the important ones. We're going to go to Ireland, England, and Belgium.
Uh-oh. Only England, Ireland, and Belgium.
Oh, right, in the right order. I guess I'm leaving out Germany and Switzerland. We like them too, but can't do five countries in 2 weeks. So Steve and I are going to fly into Manchester, and Don McAllister is going to pick us up. We're going to spend 3 days with him, and then we're going to come down to across my geography.
Pretty much straight across.
And we're going to go visit Bart for 3 days, and then we're going to hop on yet another plane, and we're going to go over and see Nightwise for 3 days.
And then you get back to Manchester to head back to the States?
That's right, so that we can take 3 inter-island flights in order to make it be as complicated as possible, so we're flying 4 separate airlines.
Fantastic. And none of them have any sort of partnerships with each other.
Right. I think there was a lot of swearing when I was trying to do that, and that was I only didn't kill myself because you were on the phone helping me, or on the horn there helping me do it, right?
That was a long evening, yeah.
That was
horrible. We were working as a good team, though, because I was looking at websites for some carriers, and you were looking at websites for other carriers, and between the pair of us, we found all the best deals.
Oh, yeah, and yet everything. I love the inter-island flights there in Europe, where it's like, yeah, it's $8 to fly, and then there's $75 in tax, and, oh, you wanted to wear your shoes on the plane? That's $20.
Well, okay, not quite shoes, but you plan to bring something with you? Luggage? You nuts?
I guess they're made for people who are flying that, like, over and back in the same hour or something. I don't know.
Well, or within the same day. You know, you'd nip over to London for a meeting and come home.
I guess so.
Or maybe overnight once with your hand baggage.
The good news for the listeners is we will be doing a tweet up in each of those areas. Dates yet to be determined, so stay tuned. But it's the last couple of weeks of August into the first. I think we come home on the 3rd of September, so the 2 weeks before that. So we will be announcing tweet up days.
Yes, and the tweet up in Maynooth will be preceded by a photo walk in Maynooth.
Yeah.
Which I'll be doing if anyone wants to come along and take pictures of the fantastic grounds of the university.
That's going to be a blast. Really looking forward to that. So I guess I should bring my camera.
I would be very cranky if you didn't bring your camera.
Well, you know, I was actually getting worried about it because of the luggage restrictions. I think if I bring my camera, I can't bring shoes.
Strap it around your neck. Stick the big lens in and then beat them over the head with it.
I guess so. Maybe it's time for that Scott E. vest.
Well, apparently that's a great way to get by baggage restrictions. It's not baggage, it's my coat.
Exactly. All right, well, we should probably kick into the show here. We got anything up on Security Light?
A follow-up first. Last week, we were very nice to Adobe. We said that they had done very well to meet their deadline and to publish their patch on the 29th, as they'd promised. Teensy-weensy problem. Patch doesn't work. It doesn't actually patch what it's meant to patch.
Oh, no.
It is a dud. So Reader and Acrobat are still vulnerable.
Now, does that so that doesn't have anything to do with if you're using Preview. Did they fix Preview already?
Well, this particular issue was Adobe only. I mean, PDFs are, by their very nature, still a dangerous format and always will be and can't be made safe. But this particular flaw that was being patched was to do with... This is, again, Adobe's lunacy. They thought it would be a really great idea to embed Flash within PDFs.
Okay.
Because that's really something you want.
Embed what in PDFs again?
Flash.
Okay.
So this flaw in Acrobat and Reader was actually a flaw in Flash.
Okay.
They patched it in Flash last month, and then they'd promised they'd patch the Flash inside Acrobat and Reader at the end of the month.
Oh.
But they have failed to patch it properly. So it's still Flash causing all these problems.
Now,
even if it's in Reader and Acrobat.
The link you posted talks about mass attacks to infect Windows PCs,
yes.
But it affects the Mac as well?
The vulnerability exists. At the moment, there's no sign of mass attacks, but that's because there aren't, not because there can't be.
Hmm. Okay. So no snarky little grin that it's a Windows problem. We're just lucky right now, not smart.
Yeah, it'd be sort of like standing at the end of a street watching your neighbor's house burn and laughing while the sparks come perilously close to your own roof.
That's a good description. I'm going to use that on people. So that's great. So are they saying anything? Do they have a plan for fixing it?
If they have, they've been quiet about it.
Okay, so stay away from Acrobat. Stay away from Flash? No.
Well, no, they patch Flash.
They patch Flash.
So they patch standalone Flash, but the problem is with Flash embedded into Reader and Acrobat.
Okay. Yeah, that's great.
Which, the very concept that you would think that a portable document format, a viewer of text, should somehow need Flash is the problem here, which is entirely Adobe's insanity.
Well, Flash is wonderful. We want Flash on everything.
Yeah, because we need Flash on our paper. What? Makes no sense. Makes no sense. And it's broken. Anyway, also, another follow-up of sorts. We talked about 2 weeks ago about a flaw in Windows XP's help system.
Right.
Well, that is being patched as part of next Tuesday's Patch Tuesday, along with another vulnerability that affects Windows 7 and two that affect Office.
Okay. Just your typical remote code execution problem, that's all?
Yeah, there's only four bulletins, which is very little, but all four are rated critical because they're all remote code execution.
Great.
So we have quality, not quantity, I guess.
So wake up your virtual machines or your real machines and patch them up.
Exactly. On Wednesday.
You know what I think about is, I think there's a lot of people who bought netbooks and they were all really cool for a few minutes and then people kind of went, well, it doesn't really help me as much as I thought it did. I bet there's a lot of sleeping netbooks right now, just sitting in corners.
That's a very good point. And the kind of thing you might pick up sometime and do your banking on, which is around about the dumbest thing you could do.
Yeah, right, right.
On an unpatched Windows machine.
Like you wait until your vacation and then go turn it on and all of a sudden things feel bad.
Yeah, you're going on vacation, you want to bring a computer, but God, that laptop's so heavy. Mm. And you grab the netbook you haven't touched in a year since the last time you went on vacation.
So if it's Linux, if it's a hacked Mac operating system on there, if it's Windows XP, whatever it is, patch it.
Patch it. Patch it before you go on holidays with it. Exactly.
Definitely. Okay.
The last thing we have is just sort of an FYI. It's all a bit murky, but it would appear that there has been some sort of hackery going on involving the iTunes Store somehow in some way.
Oh, yeah, I heard about this.
It seems to be the case that what someone did, so someone wrote a bunch of apps, got them into the App Store. We don't know if they got them into the App Store by nefarious means or if they just got them in the App Store through Apple's approvals process. But they got the apps in, and then they seem to have purchased a whole bunch of stolen iTunes accounts from the black market or something. Or they wrote their own malware, I don't know. But they seem to have somehow gotten their hands on a bunch of iTunes accounts, username and passwords, and bought their own app millions of times. Which had two effects, one of which was that their app ended up at the top of the list, and secondly, they made a shedload of other people's money.
Yeah. So wouldn't you have gotten emails saying, hey, you just bought these
yes.
things, yes. and people would notice it fairly quickly, I would think. Well, usually they
which
wait.
Is
they
what
wait
happened.
But they wait a couple of days till you've stacked yes. up some purchases, usually?
Yeah, because it costs money to process this transaction, so Apple queue them up and then process them in bulk, so that way it costs them less money on processing.
Right, right.
So really, there's no evidence that the hack was actually of the store that we've seen yet. That may change. But for now, what it seems to be a case is that people are stealing the Apple credentials in the normal way, be that through phishing attacks or through good old-fashioned keyloggers and malware of various sorts. But it seems to be more a case that the usernames and passwords are being taken in the normal way and then being used rather than there being an actual attack against the iTunes store.
So they don't think there's a vulnerability that's been exploited in iTunes?
It seems that's the case, yeah. There's some doubt that maybe something happened on the developer end, that these guys managed to get apps out that weren't properly approved, maybe. No, there's no word on that that I've been able to find. Anyway, it's all very murky. But it would appear to be the case that it's just your standard malware attacks. I mean, you have this with World of Warcraft, where they target people's World of Warcraft credentials because you can use that to make real money. Well, you know, you can do the same with your iTunes. So if you have a weak password in your iTunes account, change it and make it strong. If you're in any way worried, check your account details. And if you're being paranoid, change your password.
Hmm.
But that's pretty much all. You know, it doesn't look like there's any reason to panic. And I thought maybe we should mention it just because it's been getting a lot of press. But definitely, definitely check your purchase history.
Okay.
And if you see something strange, contact your bank and get that transaction rolled back.
One thing I didn't hear in any of the reports I heard was them saying, and Apple has refunded everybody's money.
I didn't know, but they shouldn't, though, because if it's purchased through a credit card, the bank will refund you for fraud. That's what makes a credit card different to a debit card.
Yeah. You know, some people were also saying, well, you should always use iTunes gift cards and then you're safe. But iTunes gift cards are linked you cannot use an iTunes gift card without a credit card on file.
Apparently there are ways not to do that, actually. There are ways to do that. I know a lot of Europeans have American iTunes accounts through gift vouchers, which means they don't have an American credit card.
Hmm.
But I also know it's tricky.
Okay.
But anyway, the whole point of a credit card is that you're protected from fraud. If anything happens on the card that you didn't do, the bank pay you back, and then the bank go after the criminals.
Right.
Which is why a debit card, if someone steals your debit card, they have your money and it's your problem. If someone steals stuff off your credit card, it's your bank's problem.
I like that.
Yes, which is why I never, ever, 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 ever use a debit card online. It is the most insane thing you could possibly imaginably do. Don't give it out over the phone. Don't ever let that card out of your sight. And don't ever use it in a way that isn't physical.
Good advice.
It's my worst nightmare to get up one morning and find someone's cleaned out my account and it's my problem.
Yeah, right. I like it when it's their problem.
Yeah, when it's their problem, it's fine. It's a minor annoyance. But when it's my problem, then that's a good.
So when my credit card was compromised in Mexico, it didn't cost me a dime. It was a hassle, but didn't cost me a dime. So that was nice.
Exactly. Yeah.
I still don't understand what the credit card companies gain off of me, because I use my credit card and then I pay it off every single month, never, ever, ever carry a balance. And they love me. They like fight over
keeping
merchant, me.
Every single transaction you do, the merchant has paid a fee to the credit card companies to be allowed to take credit cards.
Oh, I thought they made their money off the 22% interest rates.
Well, make some of their money that way. But they also make money off transactions, which is why some places will charge you a fee for using a credit card. So they pass that cost on to you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I have seen that in line to go skiing once. I remember seeing that.
It's not really popular anymore, but it was the done thing for a while. Now everyone just uses credit cards. So it's like, okay, that's just part of the cost of doing business. I pay for taking credit cards.
Right. All right. Well, do we have something fun to talk about?
Well, you. This was triggered by you. Because you said, we don't talk enough about the Mac.
Right.
And I thought about it and I went, well, no, we don't. But that's because there's not that much interesting happening in the Mac. So I racked my brains to find some way of talking about the Mac and ended up sort of one third talking about the Mac. But it's important. So the concept is unifying your digital world.
Okay.
When the PC came onto the market, you had a family computer. I certainly remember there was five of us in the family. We had one computer. It was a 386. So the concept of keeping your stuff in sync just did not exist. Your stuff was on your computer. That was the end of that.
Along with everybody else's.
Along with everybody else's. Now, as time went on, houses suddenly started having maybe two or three computers because, you know, there was one for dad to do his work on and then one for the family to break. And then maybe there was a nerdy kid like me who had a third computer all of their own. But there was still no problem because dad's stuff was on dad's computer, the games were on the kid's computer, and my stuff was on my computer.
Okay.
So still we have no problem. But now things have flipped around completely the other way around. It used to be five of us in the family to one computer. Now there's one of me, and if you include iPhone and iPad, then I now have five computers.
I know Steve has three running right now, not counting his iPod Touch.
Which I think you should count.
Now, in my case, I only use one computer, but I have an iPhone and iPad, so I guess I count as three now.
You count as three, yeah. So, I mean, in my case, I have a desktop, I have a laptop, and I have a work computer, and I have an iPad and I have an iPhone, so that's five.
Mm.
And trying to keep all of your stuff together is quite difficult now because the fundamental model of the computer hasn't changed. We still have local storage. So it hasn't really scaled up very well. And unfortunately, there is no silver bullet. There's no one solution to fix all. But what I thought would be useful to do is to look at the sort of five basic approaches to this problem. And what I have found in my life is that I use each of these five for something. And together, they mean that I don't waste my time stressing over this stuff.
Hmm. So you're saying you have five ways that you keep this organized?
Well, I'm saying there's five, as I can see it. Now, maybe I've missed something, but I think I've been pretty general. I sort of break the different approaches to this problem into five categories. And one of those categories will suit something in your life, most probably. So the way you end up not stressing about all this is to take a little from columns one through five and apply as appropriate. So probably the simplest approach is to compartmentalize. All work stuff goes on my work computer. All personal stuff goes on my desktop. And I just browse the web on my laptop. Therefore,
I actually think that's part of what Steve does because his like his MacBook Air has nothing on it. When he had a hard drive crash, it was like, so put a new hard drive in. I don't care.
Yeah, it's just a device. Yeah. In my case,
it's a Twitter device.
My MacBook, an appliance. That's the word I was looking for.
Right.
My MacBook Pro is my photography machine. Everything to do with photography is on that machine. I don't try to do my photography across multiple machines. Hmm. Just a nightmare. So Aperture is in one place, my Aperture library is in one place, and that's my photography computer. Likewise, my iTunes library is in one place on one computer, and my two iOS devices sync to that one computer. So that's compartmentalized.
So which computer do you keep iTunes on?
Laptop.
On your laptop. Now, is your laptop your least powerful machine or your most powerful machine?
Most powerful, which is why it's the home to Aperture 2.
Okay, that's what I was wondering. Okay.
Yeah, now this is probably all going to change massively should I ever manage to save up for that iMac I want. Because then the chances are a lot of this stuff will get shifted over to the iMac and the laptop will become sort of an internet browsing machine.
Too bad that work machine can't just wander home, you know?
I know. It's a bit heavy to stick under your arm.
They might notice.
They notice, yeah. I mean, arguably they're not the most astute, but that I think they'd notice. And I shouldn't be so mean because our security guys are really nice. But anyway.
But it's fun to mock people.
Exactly.
Okay, so compartmentalizing. Now, do you compartmentalize things like your email too?
No, not at all. It just doesn't work to compartmentalize everything. Some things are compartmentalizable. I imagine Steve does video editing. I imagine that's the other kind of thing where he has his video editing machine.
Yes, absolutely. That's what he does on his iMac, because that's the newest, most powerful machine. Video editing on a MacBook Air is not exactly a happy day.
So it's a way to burn your legs, yeah.
No, I actually do I do compartmentalize my email. I carry a BlackBerry for work and an iPhone for home. And for a while, I had my Play email on my work device. And I could not seem to stop accidentally emailing people at home that I meant to be emailing them at work, because I'm friends with a lot of people at work. So I do this big message to a bunch of bosses, and I put some poor guy's home email address, which he was not real pleased with the fourth time I did it, you know? And that's when I just said, okay, got to divorce it, got to split it in half. Can't I had to compartmentalize it, because I could never seem to notice that it was grabbing the wrong address.
I guess to some extent I do compartmentalize. We'll talk later about syncing, but my work machine isn't tied into as much as my home machines are. My address book does not sync to work.
Okay.
So I have an island of an address book in work, because I don't particularly want to send my boss a silly message by mistake. And she has no business knowing what my personal email address is.
Right.
So that's, yeah, that's I do some. Separate. Yeah, so that's again compartmentalization. Right. So that's definitely it's a very primitive approach, but it's very effective for a lot of things. So that's definitely approach number one.
Okay.
Then approach number two is to accept the fact that probably the single biggest change to the computer since we had five of the family sharing one is the concept of networking. Computers live on LANs. I don't know of a single house that has a computer that doesn't have a home network. The home network is sort of a side effect of the fact that we all want internet and we get our internet through routers these days instead of through modems, but we all have home networks. So having a central computer somewhere in the house where you keep all of your files and then you simply mounting it through the Finder on all of your other machines is a viable option in the home.
Yeah, I know something. People do that. I find that so odd to do on a laptop, because the minute you leave the house, you have nothing then. Or you don't have the stuff that you want. Like, I know a lot of people keep their iPhoto library on a centralized hard drive so everybody can see the photos, but then you can't see the photos the minute you leave the house.
Sure, but particularly if you have a household with multiple desktops, this is actually very powerful.
Right.
So you could have one machine sitting in the sitting room, say, with a whole bunch of external hard drives where you back everything up, and then everyone else in the house just connects to that machine to get out their files, and they know that everything they sent to that machine is backed up that night.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of merit to that. The other obvious part to that is iTunes has network-based sharing. So yes, my iTunes has been compartmentalized onto my laptop. But if I feel like playing some stuff on my iTunes library on my iMac, I can, because it's shared over the network.
I freaked out Steve this morning. I had music coming out of my computer, and he didn't know how I was doing it, because he knows I don't have any music. But
you
I just...
Yeah, where the hell would you get music from?
Exactly. That's crazy talk. But I had clicked on his library on his iMac, and so I was playing it in the other room. It scared him to death.
Or the other thing is, if two people in the one house both like music, you can get at each other's iTunes libraries that way.
Okay.
It could happen. It's not likely in the Sheridan household, but it could happen.
Well, okay, Kyle and Steve, Kyle and Lindsay, you know, when she's home.
Yeah, they could be sharing loads. They could be having great fun sharing their iTunes stuff behind your back.
That's good. Well, but we could share podcasts.
Ooh. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, there's a lot to be said for simply having stuff compartmentalized, but then sharing it out over the LAN. So that's certainly a potential element of your solution.
Right.
The obvious extension to that element of your solution is... don't keep anything in your house at all. We all have internets everywhere these days, so just keep it all up in the cloud.
Basic now, line your sentence there. We don't have internets everywhere necessarily.
No, but compared to 10 years ago, I guess we do.
I guess.
It's certainly becoming ever more practical. Arguably, it isn't really practical yet, but it's certainly going to become more practical rather than less.
I think Steve Jobs thought we were there like 2 years ago. He acts it's all in the cloud.
Yeah, but he probably is. He probably has 1600 meg broadband to his house.
Right.
He's Steve.
And in his car and in his shop and in the garage and everywhere, right?
So, yeah, so arguably he's not living in the real world. But nonetheless, he can't ignore cloudy stuff.
He probably has an AT&T signal where he lives. Anyway, sorry.
The first thing to say is this is not a new idea. This is a pet peeve of mine. Cloud... me bollocks, right? Cloud. This whole cloud computing thing is a PR stunt. It's not anything new. The concept of client-server computing is around about as old as the computer.
I feel like the pendulum just swung back.
Exactly.
All of a sudden, we're at VT100 terminals hooked into the IBM mainframe, right?
or the old software as a service buzzword?
Ugh.
That's the cloud.
I hate that.
Or the cloud is software as a service. Right. But it's really, really old. It's not a new idea at all. It's just been given the new code of P or paint. But anyway, it is actually a very... To prove that it's old, IMAP is not a new protocol. IMAP is cloud email.
How long has IMAP been around? Long time?
I should have probably checked that on Wikipedia, but it's at least a decade old, probably significantly more.
I'll do a search while we're yapping.
So the concept of IMAP is that all of your mailboxes are stored on the server, and your mail client is just a window into the server. So you read something and you mark it as read, it's marked as read on the server. You go to a different computer, you go to your iPhone, you go to your iPod, you have a different window into the exact same stuff, because it's all on the server anyway, none of it's on your client. So when you mark something as read on the iPad, it instantly is marked red on the iPhone, it's instantly is marked red on your desktop, it's instantly marked red everywhere. So that is the cloud, and it lives on the internet. It doesn't live on any of your devices. And that means you can access it from all of your devices if you have internet access.
IMAP was invented in 1986.
Wow. Okay, I didn't think it was quite that old. There we go, QED.
Yeah.
The cloud is not new.
And yet so many of us used POP email for the longest time. If anybody's listening does POP, basically the problem you run into is if you have, like Steve, an iMac and a MacBook Air, you download the email when you're sitting at the MacBook Air. When you go up to the iMac, the mail's not there anymore. It's gone. But if you're on IMAP, like POP. Bart says, it just does everything everywhere all the time.
Because you never leave the server. POP email literally takes it from the server and puts it on a local machine. So it's gone from the server. So if you have one computer, that's perfectly fine. The moment you have more than one computer, it's a complete and utter disaster.
See, I don't even call it perfectly fine, even if you only have one computer, because then it's not backed up anywhere unless you're good at it. But if you use IMAP, it's backed up.
Assuming you have a reliable provider.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
so who do you trust more, your ISP?
Who hires professional system administrators or me?
Well, maybe I know too much about too many sysadmins.
Yeah, but for the other 99.87% of the population, Bart, I think relying on anybody's professional sysadmin is better than on themselves.
And for work email, it absolutely is. Because if someone messes up the IMAP server in work, it's work email, work messed it up, it's work's problem. Yeah, nothing to do with you.
Yeah, what I'm fascinated by, in fact, maybe people ought to study IMAP more closely, is it's probably the only syncing service I know of that doesn't cause duplicates.
But it's not syncing. You're just looking at the server. It's a window into the server. The client.
No, because I can unplug my Ethernet jack and I've still got it on my computer. So it's in two places. It's not in one.
It's caching. It's caching is all it's doing. Yeah, some clients choose to cache local copies of the mails. But it's not really syncing.
Look, whatever it's doing it right, and the syncing people ought to do it that way.
But that's because the mail can only come from one place. The mail all comes into the server, and you then view it from lots of places. So it's very, very different problem to having a file where you have a local copy on four machines, and you edit the file four different places at the same time, and then what?
Fine. I guess we should talk about syncing then.
I was just going to say, so the next obvious one is syncing. Duplicate, triplicate, quadlicate, quinticate, whatever you want.
How many contacts did I say I ended up with in my Apple address book? It was something like 57,000 contacts.
Possibly,
just one day I looked at it and it's trying to sync, and it's just in this infinite loop of syncing and adding and adding and adding and adding. It was lovely. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, it's very error prone. Sync is hard. Sync is exceptionally hard, very error-prone. Conflicts are literally unavoidable. If you take the one file, it's on your laptop, you sync it to your desktop, you edit it that night on your desktop, you forget to sync again, you leave the next day with your laptop and you edit the file again. When you try to sync them again, there is a conflict. And no amount of magic can resolve that conflict. An intelligent human being has to decide how to make the square peg fit in the round hole. So you cannot avoid conflicts when you sync more than one way. Unidirectional sync is fantastic. That's how I do so many backups. You do backups that way too.
Right. I just say, take this, make it look like that.
Yeah. You take this one, and you end up with a read-only copy, which means that you have no conflicts. You just push it out, push it out, push it out. Absolutely fine. So unidirectional sync is easy and it works well. But as soon as you start this bidirectional sync stuff, you end up in a mess. And if you were to try to do basic basic sync between three or four computers in your house without getting some sort of central authoritative place involved, you have a complete disaster. So you can never use basic synchronization for five devices, which is why we now have a hybrid of the cloud with syncing, which is really where things have gone recently. And that's a big new change that has made a big difference. So you have the authoritative copy in the cloud, and every one of your five devices does a simple bidirectional sync with that one authoritative copy, rather than all five devices trying to sync with each other, which okay. is where Dropbox, that's what Dropbox is. That's Dropbox's magic. And it's bloody fantastic. Evernote does the same magic trick. MobileMe in theory does the same magic trick, but proves that you can do it wrong. You can actually mess it up.
Oh, no, it's flawless. I never have trouble. It you know, it does it within its own stuff. Like on my address book, I'll have – constantly this happens. Someone will have the same home address within one contact. The home address will be in there four or five times.
Yeah, it is possible to get anything wrong. But the concept of merging clouds with basic synchronization has resulted in some fantastic services. And Dropbox is by far my favorite. Evernote is a close second. They have really good conflict resolution. They simply make a second copy and say, you have two copies of this, one from this date, one from this date. You may want to pick one later. You may not care. I'm not going to annoy you with it with a stupid pop-up you can't get rid of.
So how do you use Dropbox? What do you sync through Dropbox?
Dropbox to me is like a magic folder that anything I put in there is magically beamed to all of my computers.
Right.
So if I'm preparing for something, let's say I have a presentation to give, I'll do all of my prep work in my Dropbox. So basically, the Dropbox is where my current work goes. I look at it as my, this is what I'm working on this week, this month place. And that means that I can have a moment of inspiration on any of my computers or my iPad or my iPhone. I can work on whatever it is I'm working on. And it's all in sync. So I do something on my desktop. I come home. And I finish it on my laptop. It's the same thing because it's all going through the cloud.
So
I have a full local copy. So it's not like if the cloud vanishes, all my data's gone, because there's a complete copy on every machine. But they all stay in sync thanks to the magic of the cloud.
So if you were to delete it in the cloud, the copy is on your local desktop. But as soon as it syncs, it'll disappear from locally.
Sure, but I have Time Machine, so I'll pull it back.
Okay. I also believe it's a full local copy.
Time Machine has a complete versioning of it, and Dropbox has its own versioning on the cloud too.
Right.
So you have versioning on each of your copies, with the exception of the iPhone and the iPad, versioning in the cloud. So the amount of backups of a file on Dropbox is stupendous, which
yeah.
is good.
Now, do you pay for beyond the 2 gig?
No, because a couple of people have been nice enough to use my code thingy. What's the word?
Affiliate. Kind of thing
for referral code thing, yeah. Right. So, so I have 2.5 gigs, which is enough for me, because really it's anything I'm working on currently goes into Dropbox. And when it's finished, I've given the presentation, it gets archived away onto my one authoritative source of stuff, which is my laptop, which is backed up religiously.
Okay,
so again, compartmentalizing and syncing, sort of a hybrid of everything. So, the Dropbox is for the current stuff. And if I'm going to a meeting, anything I think I might need in the meeting, I just drop it into the Dropbox. It go to the meeting with nothing more than my iPad, because that's how I've been going to all my meetings recently, is just the iPad.
Hmm.
And it's magically there.
So you use your home devices to do work for work. You don't compartmentalize that.
It depends. Not much, I'll be honest. I may use my work devices to do stuff for home a little more often.
but I mean, if you're using your Dropbox and you're using your iPad for work.
True.
Okay.
Yeah, but I use the iPad for work, but I don't do work from home.
I got you. Okay.
So the iPad is multifunctional, but not at the same time.
Okay, and you put work things into Dropbox. Do you worry about the security of that?
Yes, which is why I would never in a million years, if I have sensitive stuff in work, it does not go into Dropbox.
Okay.
Like, there's just no way in hell that a bunch of username and passwords would ever end up in my Dropbox, ever.
Right.
Now, Dropbox is very good and it's all over SSL and stuff, but at the same time...
You just don't take the chance.
I just don't take the chance.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And Evernote is very similar. So Evernote is like a magic note paper that's with you everywhere you go. It's like having the same access to the same piece of paper from everywhere. So I have a document that I've been working on at my desk, which is my prep work for a meeting. I go to the meeting and then I have a bunch of outcomes from that meeting. Well, I just append them to the same document on the iPad, and then I get home or I get back to my desk and it's there. Everything I've done at the meeting is already waiting for me at my desk.
Hmm. It's almost like it makes your iPad a remote extension of your real computers.
Yes. Yeah, I really do think so. I guess in some ways that makes it like the Palm Folio sort of idea. Only with an infinite distance I can walk with it.
Right. I was thinking about this when we were discussing that we seem to be talking iPad and iPhone all the time, and I know there are people who are yet to be of the iOS persuasion. And they got to be getting sick of it. I mean, there isn't a show we do, and I'm not blaming anybody else, I'm blaming us, that this is what we talk about all the time. But when I started thinking about that, I realized I still spend probably close to 3 or 4 hours a day on my Mac, and I can't use my Mac at work. So most of my waking hours when I'm away from work, I'm on my Mac. So it's a hugely integral, important part of everything I do. It's just that these other distractions have come along that are entertaining and more portable.
I don't even think they're entertaining. Well, they are. You can play games, and games are fun. But to me, they actually make my Mac more powerful.
Mm.
I can now. I used to have a physical paper notebook that went to every meeting with me that I would write in. And that notebook was sitting on my desk in work, and it was under my arm when I was going to a meeting. I couldn't do that on the computer because the computer was stuck to my desk.
Right.
I never bring laptops to meetings because as soon as you open that screen, you've just erected this wall between you and the people you're talking to. And if everyone does it, you may as well just all be sitting in your office over a conference call. What's the point in having a meeting?
That's why I like conference calls.
I guess. We don't do them. We always do face-to-face, and I like it that way.
Yeah.
So I would never bring a computer to a face-to-face meeting. You can put the iPod flat on the desk. It is like a sheet of paper.
So the fact that it's not tilted in the way. Down, it's not that physical barrier.
It's actually slightly smaller than my physical notebook.
Yeah.
And it uses exactly the same way. So I have now managed to computerize my notebook, which means my Mac is more powerful than it was before I had the iPad.
I see what you're saying. And because you do it, so you take your notes in Evernote, the Evernote application on the iPad?
Yeah. So as I'm preparing for a meeting, you know, it may be a week in the run-up to it, every time something strikes me, oh, must remember to mention that at the meeting, I'll open the appropriate Evernote and type it in there and then. I might be at home and suddenly, you know, whoa, sugar, yeah, I really must remember to raise that at the meeting. Yeah, type it in. And it all just magically comes together. It's everywhere. And then I'm in the meeting and there I have it all. And then I make, you know, my whatever outcomes and they're magically everywhere too.
That's a really cool use of it. I do find that taking the iPad, what it does take using the iPad in a meeting is for the novelty to wear off. Because the first few times I did it, it was just like, oh, God, I mean, I just wanted to take some notes and everybody wanted to talk about it. And of course, you know, I love that part. But after a while, it's like, no, can we just get back to work? And a lot of people accused me of trying to draw that attention. I was like, no, I'm just using it.
Yeah. No, I was, thankfully, I meet the same people when I have meetings. So it was very, very quick.
Okay.
The novelty was gone. And I was just like, okay, yeah, you know, that's your notebook. That's fine.
Okay, good.
Now, what I will say is that multitasking will make this a lot nicer.
Having that multitasking or fake multitasking on the iPhone, every day I'm like, when is it coming to the iPhone?
The iPad, you mean?
iPad, yeah. It just drives me crazy that I don't have it, that I have to get all the way out of something.
Now, in fairness, because the iPad is such a snappy little processor, it's not a big deal to switch apps. It's just if they're on different screens, it's a bit tedious. It's like home button, swipe, swipe, click. Okie dokie, that's that. Home button, swipe, swipe, click. Instead of just double click and click and tap.
Well, I'll give you an example of where it did drive me crazy was I was working in an application and they had a help file. I said, okay, cool, let me check the help file. And it opened a web browser.
For God's sake.
Now I'm not even
stupid.
In my document anymore. It was like, ah.
Well, okay, that's something I should say about Evernote. If you're in the middle of editing something and you hit that home button and you go do something and you go back to Evernote, you're right back in the middle of your edit.
Oh, that's nice.
It's as if you were multitasking. Yeah, okay, the app has stored its state, quit, and then it's opened and restored itself from where the saved state. But that doesn't matter because as far as you're concerned, I was in the middle of typing this sentence. I'm still in the middle of typing this sentence. I'm exactly where I left off. And if you open a file in Dropbox on the iPad, it does the same thing. So I could have, you know, something open in Dropbox, a diagram or something I want to refer to, and I'm taking notes in Evernote, I can flip over and back between the two and I don't lose anything. I don't have to go find the file again, open the file again. It's where I left it.
Okay, that's good.
But, the fast switching would be nice.
Yeah, that's going to be cool. And I like being able to just get to it on that little bottom bar.
Yeah, exactly. It's just easier.
Okay, here we are talking about the iPad and iPhone.
But as I say, I don't see it as separate. And the reason everyone's talking about it is because it's new.
Right.
This is a whole new extension to our Macs. It's a whole new way of making our digital lives even cooler. It's like a new app, only it's an app you physically take with you.
Right.
So I don't draw a line between the Mac and iOS.
Okay.
And I could get really nerdy and say that they run the same kernel. But that seems silly to me.
All right. What else? That's only four.
No, that's five. Compartmentalize, share, cloud, sync, cloud plus sync.
Oh, I thought we were still on sync. Okay, I got you.
Oh, so cloud plus sync is a whole... That's a new paradigm that I didn't used to see before. You either were the cloud or you were syncing, but this concept of both is as far as I can see, new. Someone may find some protocol from 1986 that proves me wrong, but I think it's new.
Well, that's pretty cool. I like your progress on that. I think this is an interesting way to go. I use Dropbox, but not very much. I guess I don't, the biggest part probably is having one Mac, and I do all of my work. I think if Feeder had a way of working through the iPad, I would maybe be more inclined to do this because I do all my work in Feeder. But if I put it in Dropbox, or if I try to use Dropbox, there's issues with
how
to do
client.
That.
Yeah,
so it's a little bit hard. So I don't really sync much of anything in that. Now, I did, on your advice, remember we were talking about all my syncing problems. I started using my iPhone as an iPod. And yes, Nightwise referred to me as Captain Obvious when I figured out you could use it as an iPod.
Actually, yeah, I was going to say, because in terms of straightforward synchronization, that's something I do. I don't have my iPhone going through MobileMe. I just have my iPhone syncing direct to my Mac. So it's a simple one-to-one sync.
Is
that working out any better for you?
Well, I'm not sure, because I didn't tell it to sync my contacts and that sort of thing. But this last week, one day... my computer just started heating up. Fans are flying. I look, it's just going berserk. And that little MobileMe sync is spinning really fast. And I watched it, and it did it for like 2 hours. And I finally put my machine to sleep. But guess what? Everything's synced now.
Oh. So it untied itself.
Yeah, whatever it got its shorts in a bind about, it seems to have done it. There's one thing that I still can't figure out. While we've been talking here, I created a test contact in my address book, and I hit sync now, and then I opened my address book on my iPad, and sure enough, it was there. Actually, as soon as I put up address book, it started spinning the little...
Something's changed. I got to reload. Yeah.
So I was all excited and everything. So I said, okay, now let me edit the contact in the iPad.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to say sync now. There isn't sync button.
There is in iTunes.
I'm not in iTunes. I'm in my address book.
Okay, but are you syncing through iTunes or are you syncing through MobileMe for this stuff?
Through MobileMe. I'm not plugging it in hardware-wise.
Well, in theory, with push, it should just happen.
Right, and in all the time we've been talking, it hasn't. Nothing's happened over on the iPad side.
Okay, but I thought you'd stopped using MobileMe and started using direct syncing. Or
No. That's why I said I didn't. I just because it suddenly synced. Sunk. It sounds like something from The Grinch. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I've always had trouble pluralizing sync.
Yeah. So I'm not quite sure how to make it go when you do something on the iPad side or the iPhone side. That's one thing I have yet to figure out how to say sync, go, yay.
It should, in theory, if you have push turned on, it should happen instantly. And if you don't, it should happen in whatever your interval is.
Maybe I don't have push turned on. It's push inside. Where's push?
It's in the, said iPad or iPhone.
Oh, I'll go iPad for the moment. Well, this might not be fascinating for other people, but maybe what I got to go look for. Notifications? Is it in there?
No. It should be under the mail and calendar contacts.
Ah.
And then you should choose the
account.
Fetch
new data says push. So does that mean it pushes from here? Can I say push now?
Well, no, because push means...
Oh, it's set to manually.
Oh.
How do I manually push it?
I have positively no idea how you do that. So okay. set it to either pull
minutes,
or sync.
I guessed.
Or pull or push.
Wait, pull? Push.
Well, pull is the oldie way. We'll do it every 15 minutes. And push is the new way. We'll hoosh it out straight away.
Whoa. Well, wait a minute. So push is on. And then fetch is the step set, below it.
Yeah, which schedule is set to what?
The schedule below is used when push is off. This is so confusing. So if I have push on,
it should.
Says new data will be pushed to your iPad from the server. It's not saying it pushes back.
It should, though.
Well, it doesn't say that. It says new
but the
data
whole
will
concept
be pushed.
Push is it's instant. It's there's a permanent connection between your iPad and the MobileMe server that's always open, and data can whoosh through at any time. That's the concept of push notification of push anything.
Hmm.
So you should never have to check in, is there an update? You should always know straight away because you're constantly in communication with each other.
Hmm.
Like I say, MobileMe is an example. MobileMe is a perfect example that the architecture of Cloud Plus Sync isn't foolproof.
Yeah.
Because Dropbox and Evernote can do it well. Apparently Exchange does it well too. And apparently MobileMe uses the Exchange protocol, but it still manages to do it really badly.
Yeah, it seems to be boogery.
Having said that, MobileMe between multiple Macs is... Hang on, we're going to find a big piece of wood here. Flawless.
Actually, so I just tested again. I changed it again on the Mac, and it changed it on the iPad, but it didn't take the iPad changes and push them back. So apparently it's one way.
It shouldn't be. There's something wrong, because the whole point is that it's both ways instantly.
Sick. All right, well, I have more work to do. Well, anywho, I guess that's going to wind it up, but we did manage to talk about the Mac, and like I said, I use my Mac all the time. I mean, it's hugely important.
So do I. There's no way in hell that a photographer could use an iPad as their only device. Never going to happen.
Well, never. That's assuming okay. That the technology yes. Never advances.
For a given value of never. I can choose to reinterpret never.
They're only a certain
or
level.
I'll use my favorite politician phrase, for the foreseeable future, which I believe is 0 seconds.
only people who studied a lot of math or physics or science in general would find that as humorous as we just did. At least we entertain ourselves, right, Bart?
Yeah, exactly. Anyway.
The never concept, Steve Jobs said that crazy thing when he was on stage at All Things D. He said, I can envision a day when people would edit video on their iPhone. And we all went, oh, God, Steve, that's ridiculous. And then he...
Yeah, but he already knew it was coming.
Well, he did it the next week. I mean, the fact that we're editing video on an iPhone says that we will be using iPad-type, devices like that for photography in the not-that-distant future.
And he also said in that same interview about the tractor analogy, and I think he's spot on. Or truck, sorry, not tractor.
Yeah, maybe we should save that in where we're going to have our next discussion be, is there a future for the Mac? Because I have a lot of opinions on that I have not heard other people say, so.
And I do too, and I've done a lot of shouting at my iPod, stuff, whenever people have said, oh, Mac's dead. Oh, bloody well isn't.
And that's not what he said either.
It's not what he said. I've had someone actually say, Steve Jobs said the Mac was dead at D8, and I went, prove it, and they linked me to the D8 talk, and I went, that's great, that link is definitely to what Steve Jobs said. But it doesn't prove your case in the slightest.
Right.
Anyway, sorry, we're about to start on another great topic. We'll leave it for next week.
That'll be our teaser. All right, Bart, well, we will talk to you again next week. And it's been lovely chatting with you as always.
Absolutely, always a pleasure. And until next time, happy computing.
Now, don't forget to send your reviews in for me for next week's show. I want to be able to relax at Disneyland and not have to worry about the show. So help me out here, guys, okay? Remember, the iPhone actually has a terrific mic in it, so if you have one of those, you can even use that for your recording. They sound great. That's what Nightwise uses. Even though his come out kind of weird, it's the content, not the microphone. Well, if you have any questions, especially the dumb kind, send them on over to allison@podfeet.com. Please be sure to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. I'm betting there's going to be quite a lot of twit pics coming from Disneyland this week. Anyway, thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.